You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the film. Really well done, and bravo to Brookings Institution for having us here. I'm Shirley Halpern from Variety. We have magazines out in the lobby. You can see it's a very thick issue, but towards the back, we have our cannabis and entertainment package, which we do twice a year, and we look at, you know, well, in this issue, we look at stoner sequels, which is, you know, pop movies, and the difference between making movies, you know, 10 or 15 years ago and today, so kind of relevant to today. And we also looked at the economic models of dispensaries in Los Angeles. So that's the editorial, and I encourage you to check it out. Obviously, this is a big week for marijuana. 420 is on Friday, and you know, dispensaries have extended hours, and it's a big thing here in Los Angeles. So anyway, we're so thrilled to have you guys here. I want to just introduce the panel. To my right is John Hudak. He's the Deputy Director and Senior Fellow at the Center for Effective Public Management. Thanks for being here. To his right is, of course, Jen, who you know from the film, and her mom, Beth. And then we have Jason Beck, who is the founder and co-owner of Alternative Herbal Health Services. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Okay. Sometimes I do it opposite way. And George Burroughs, who's the creative and film director for the Brookings Institution. So thank you. Thank you for being here, guys. And girls. Jason, I wanted to start with you because you are very much an activist in this world, especially in policy. In marijuana policy, and you've really seen, you've seen the legislation come up from nothing to what we have today, which is, you know, 8 fully legal states and more than half of the country allowing medical marijuana. You have cerebral palsy, which is a genetic condition. Can you tell us how you use marijuana to control it?
So I started smoking cannabis at about the age of 13, and I was born with cerebral palsy. And so cerebral palsy is a disease that you can only get when you are born. It's a muscle disease that's actually in the cerebral cortex of your brain that affects all of your muscles and development. All of a sudden at 13, I just started smoking cannabis. It was kind of the neighborhood that I grew up in. A lot of my friends smoked, so I tried it out. And the first time I tried it out, I noticed that I was able to have a much clearer thought process. I was able to move a lot smoother. And I noticed that there was a lot of relief that I received. I didn't have as many twitches, muscle spasms, and things like that. And there wasn't the medical research at all at that time to be able to quantify why that was happening. I just knew that it made me feel better.
And George, can you tell us, because this is very much in line with the film, The Life She Deserves, why did you decide to delve into this project in a film?
We did a short video with John, and I hadn't really been exposed to the cannabis industry, and I don't think a lot of people have, unless you smoke. And we did an interview, and I think it was with Rabbi Kahn, Jeff, and when we left there, I turned to John, and with everything he named that people were using, the patients that he had coming in, it's you can't fit it into a smaller. It has to be bigger to tell a story, to understand, because a lot of people, all they think about, if they're not familiar with cannabis, it's the stigma around it. And the only way to kind of get through that to, say, and point to research that people can't, you know, wag a finger at and say, shame on you, have to tell this longer story and share a human experience.
But the whole idea of research is a challenge in and of itself with marijuana. How has that changed recently, or is there sort of hope for further research?
I think John could handle that.
John?
Sure, I'll take that question.
Go for it.
So what a lot of people don't appreciate is that of all of the drugs that fall under the 5 controlled substance schedules, marijuana is the hardest drug that exists in terms of conducting medical research. It's easier to conduct research on cocaine or heroin or MDMA. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is cannabis's Schedule I status, but part of it, too, is that, for instance, those of you who work in the activist community know this. If you are conducting research on medical marijuana, you can't stroll down to the dispensary or talk to a grower like Matt and say, listen, I need like 40 kilograms of this substance for the patients that I have in my study. You have to get your cannabis from the most obvious place to get cannabis in the United States, and that's Mississippi, right? That's whenever you think cannabis, you think that's definitely the place that grows the best stuff. So the University of Mississippi has a grower there, and he's a really good professional, and he grows this product. But it's the only substance we have that is only single-sourced for medical research. Now, in 2016, when the Obama administration, in its august wisdom, decided not to reschedule marijuana, what they did do at the same time was say, you know what, we're going to lift that monopoly on the growth of research-grade cannabis. We're going to allow other institutions like Ole Miss, probably a little better than Ole Miss, sorry, any Ole Miss alums in the room, to start producing research-grade cannabis. Of course, the Obama administration ends on January 20th, 2016. President Trump decides to appoint marijuana reformer Jeff Sessions as attorney general, and the DEA and DOJ have refused to put out an additional license to grow research-grade cannabis. So the opportunities are there to lift those restrictions on research. Political appointees are there to make sure that those opportunities are wasted.
And I think a lot of people don't know that there's challenges at every corner when it comes to marijuana. Not only are there growing challenges and the licensing of it and the sort of legislative stuff, but there's also transportation. There's banking issues. You know, you can't run a pot company and put your money in the bank. Federal laws versus state laws impact so many things beyond just access to the drug. Jen and Beth, I wanted to ask you guys, what were the sort of frustrations that you came up against? I mean, we saw, you know, that the drugs that she was being prescribed were not working for her. So you make the decision, okay, you're going to try it. Then come the hurdles. What did you sort of have to overcome?
Well, I think the first thing we had to overcome was when we first moved to Colorado, we tried CBD oil, and that just made me tank and almost have a grand mal seizure. And so we were like, oh crap, like we moved out here for CBD oil and it doesn't even work. So, you know, we had to find other oils that worked for me.
Beth, was that decision to go to Colorado? I mean, we see in the film that obviously wasn't an easy one. You know, you had to basically split up the family. But did you have a conviction that something there would work?
Yeah, I mean, we, like Jen said, when it didn't, we were kind of like, oh, oops. But I just had faith. I knew that we had to do something. I mean, we couldn't go on with – that couldn't be her life. That couldn't be the end of her life. You know, just taking these medications that were causing her so much more harm than good. So, you know, we just – felt like we should just keep plugging. And yeah, it was heart-wrenching, you know, to split up our family. You know, I have another daughter, and that was difficult for her too. And, you know, it's just every day was a struggle. Jen had to go to a high school she didn't want to go to. She wanted to be with her friends. So there were tons, and there was financial struggles. And you know, then we started meeting other families and we're like, oh my God, there's like 300 families here doing exactly what we're doing. And that's just the epilepsy community. I mean, you know, there's the Crohn's community and the cancer community and the, you know, all these people who have to become medical refugees and go to other states just to get access. And then once they have access, they're stuck there. They're prisoners in that state. They can't leave. You know, I had to sneak her home one time because I was like, she just needs to see her friends. So, you know, nervously packed up some cannabis and drove across state lines, drove because we couldn't fly. So, I mean, the hurdles are countless hurdles. And, you know, taking her to the hospital and standing in front of the video EEG monitor so that I could give her oils because they, you know, didn't want her to take them in the hospital. So a million hurdles for every patient, not just ours. I mean, that's kind of – Jen is a pretty compelling story, but we met others who were even more compelling than us, and millions of patients, literally. Like, every state law that's been passed has been passed by patients going to their state houses sick, dying, you know, day after day after day, educating their legislature. So – yeah, that was a long answer. Sorry.
No, it was a great answer. And that's exactly what I was getting at, is like everything is a challenge. You can't even ingest the medicine, you know, at the time or the place that you happen to be in. And these are things that I think people don't really realize until they get really deep into it. Jason, do you think a movie like this and the sort of creative attention that it gets in this way helps drive the agenda towards acceptance?
100%. 100%. These types of tales really bring everything home and really puts it in a relatable stance for people from all across the country. And although you can't travel with weed for cannabis from state to state, you can travel with cannabis on a video, and that's not against the law.
Yeah, fair point. George, who do you think is the target audience for this film?
Like my aunt or people that voted for Trump, stuff like that. I was having a phone call with her when I was driving home, and I was explaining to her what I was working on. And again, this goes to the people that only know the stigma. They don't understand the possibilities. They're not familiar with the plant. And I mentioned to her, and I mentioned Jen's story and how she does it. And she pauses for a moment. She goes, "Okay, I can get behind that." And I was like, okay, yeah, this is what we need to do. And so you notice we don't show application of the medication. We don't show a T-shirt with a pot leaf on it. We show it as what it is, medicine, and how it's grown. It's basically an artisanal product. It's super clean. They catalog it, so it's tracked with a number. And we did talk a little bit about plant counts, and the reason why that's important is because when a patient can't get what they need, they end up going on the street, and there's not a number to track it if something's wrong with it, to find out what went wrong, and they don't know what they're getting. So it was very important to show that that is a real problem. And I think people that – everybody has had somebody in their family that has been touched by an illness where it might have helped. And
I want to go back to the stigma a little bit because, you know, I know a lot of parents here in California who are grappling with the issue of how do I talk to my kids about marijuana. It's legal here. You smell it everywhere. You see it everywhere. Did you also have that sort of moment where it's like, I need to explain a drug to my daughter? And how did you do it?
Of course. I mean, you know, Jennifer understands, as my other daughter understands, is that just like any medicine, cannabis also has negative effects to it, potentially, right? There is such a thing as becoming kind of going over that other side to where you're using it to escape or for whatever. So just like with any medicine, you treat it with the respect it deserves, just like you would with anything, you know. And we talked a lot about that, actually. And you know, before we decided to use cannabis as a medicine, I did have that stigma too, because I was brought up, you know, don't smoke pot. It'll lead to this and that. And then when I actually started reading about it and understanding it myself, I realized, you know, this isn't more dangerous than the toxic medications. You know, I gave Jennifer medications that made her hallucinate, you know, and cannabis has never done that for her. So you treat it with respect, you know, just like anything in your drug cabinet. You wouldn't sit and take 20 Advil, right? You take one, you need it, takes your headache away, you're done, right? Same with cannabis, no matter what form you're using.
How old was she when the conversations first started?
Well, I mean, I talked to my kids about cannabis before we even decided to use it as a medicine, like most moms do, you know. Stay away from it. It's illegal. Don't use it, that kind of thing. And then when we started using it as medicine, was she, we're what, 14, 13?
13.
13. You know, the conversation changed a little bit, but it was still the same message, you know, mm-hmm. respect the plant, respect what it's doing for you, but also, you know, respect the potential harms.
I'm just curious if that goes up against school teaching, because that's what I think a lot of kids find here with their parents, is that the school says, you know, I mean, this especially was true before recreational was passed, you know, you're supposed to tell if, you know, your parent is smoking pot mm-hmm. while dropping you off at school. Jen, I mean, what did you learn in school about cannabis before you started trying it?
Well, I always learned that cannabis was, you know, bad. It's a drug. You have to stay away from it. If, you know, if anyone offers it to you, you know, say no. All the, you know, stereotypical things, you know, say no to drugs. That was basically it. But, I mean, you know, being in high school, obviously there's a lot of people around that do smoke, and I never really understood like why you would need to do that, especially recreationally. But now looking at it as a medicine and using it as a medicine, it's really weird just to see other people using it recreationally and not even understanding that it is a medicine and it can help for so many things.
I mean, this just goes back to that. It's so complicated, you know? What, Jason?
So I think one of the big things with messaging, especially to deliver for parents to their kids, is with California, we didn't go with the word recreational. We went with the terminology of adult use, and that was to give the clear impression that it is for adults and for the adult use, not to be used recreationally. Recreationally is kind of gives the impression that we're marketing to children. You have the Department of Parks and Recreation, all parks and everything, they're called recreational facilities and things like that. And so that was one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we were sending a clear message that this is for the adult consumption. The medical side is totally different, but as far as on the adult side, strictly adult use.
Yeah, but the adults are key to this. I mean, John, don't you think it's like the parents, you know, in order to undo thoughts that are so pervasive and so ingrained in our culture, it takes a generation. So it really is up to the parent to raise the child that will change the messaging. You write about the marijuana mess. How does the family fit into that, and what needs to be done at this point?
Well, the family is really key, and it could be family like Beth and Pat who are advocating for their daughter, in Jen's case, thankfully able to advocate for herself as well. There are a lot of patients who are not so lucky to be able to advocate for themselves. But I think family needs to be more broadly defined. In a lot of cases, children who are epileptic or veterans who have severe PTSD or individuals with MS or people dying of cancer end up being pretty voiceless. Patients are voiceless. People of color are voiceless in a lot of cases. Individuals with records that include being arrested for having a joint on you a lot of times are voiceless. And so there is a community and a family, whether it's an immediate family, whether it's a policy advocacy family, whether it's some other social group like a VFW or the American Legion, who helps bring voice to the voiceless. One veteran is not going to change the mind of the American VA, but the American Legion saying something is something that the VA secretary, whenever he gets appointed, is really going to take note of. Family and community in this space is so critical, because unfortunately, like a lot of issues in our country that require change or where there are real policy deficits, the people who are hurt the most are the people who are listened to the least.
Wow, that's a great answer. Jason, you deal with a lot of lawmakers. You're very involved. You go down to D.C. You lobby. What is the deal with political parties and marijuana? It feels like things are changing a little bit. It's not so black and white. It's not my side versus your side as much. What's happening?
It's very, very true. There are a number of Republican candidates that are Republican congressmen that are definitely either freshmen and are totally in support of cannabis, or that are switching and turning a new rock or turning a new leaf, in essence. But I think at the same time, too, what we really have to work on the most is a lot of our senior members, because even on both sides of the fence, Republican and Democrat, you have a number of people that do not support cannabis at all. You know, just for instance, you have Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi. They have never been cannabis advocates, never voted, you know, never been vocal for cannabis, but yet they represent our base and they represent us, and they're not representing us.
John, what needs to happen legislatively?
Gosh, a lot needs to happen legislatively. One of the things that I think is the most exciting that's happening legislatively is what some of what Jason just touched on. There is a lot of polarization in this country. Democrats agree with Democrats and they don't agree with other people. Republicans agree with Republicans, they don't agree with other people. But on this issue, it transcends party. There are Democrats and Republicans who are just awful on this issue, who put their hands over their ears and don't want to hear anything. And then you have legislation that's sponsored by Cory Booker, one of our most liberal, progressive United States senators, and Rand Paul, who's one of our most conservative. Other than maybe prison reform, what the hell do those two agree on? They agree on cannabis. They come at it in different ways. They come at it because of different motivations. But ultimately, they vote in lockstep when those things come out. To me, that's a ray of hope for policy reform to deal with things like banking issues, tax issues, interstate access issues, things like descheduling or rescheduling, issues that face the patient, the business, and ancillary businesses that work in this space. And that's you feel hope if there's a bipartisan effort on this. But as Jason said, there's a lot of gatekeepers. There's a lot of committee chairmen in both parties. There is Republican House leadership right now who's vehemently opposed to this, who are able to stop this single-handedly, stop reforms single-handedly. But I think in the long run, you look at who is coming up and frankly, who's dying out. And that generational replacement in the public and that mm-hmm. generational replacement, especially in the Congress, is the arc of marijuana is toward justice, right? It's toward reforms in this space. You don't have a lot of 30-year-old or 40-year-old congressmen, Mr. Kennedy the exception, who comes into Congress and is like, it's a gateway drug and only bad people do it. But you see a lot of people who are nearing retirement who say those things. And in order to address these issues, the issues that a lot of legislators don't hear enough, unfortunately, you have to wait. You have to wait for the right people to come in mm-hmm. who are listening and the wrong people to die in office or retire or be humble enough to retire.
Well, one other point, too, is a lot of our messaging that comes from the cannabis community often falls on a lot of deaf ears, because a lot of us from the cannabis community don't represent the plant right and don't uphold the messaging right. You know, we want to go into congressional offices, but we want to dress like clowns and try to deliver a message, and that just doesn't work.
Beth, in your viewing how the states deal with medical marijuana, do you think the federal government will come around in our lifetime to catching up?
I do. I'm hopeful. That's kind of my nature, though. but I do. I've seen a huge shift in Congress just in the 4 or so years that I've been going to the Hill and talking to legislators. I've seen a huge shift. As been said, is a lot is on the Republican side that there's a lot of support that wasn't there before. And as John said, you know, we have a few gatekeepers that once they're out of there, I think you will start seeing bills go through pretty quickly, because there's a lot of support in Congress. We have the votes for numerous bills to be passed. It's just really those that are sitting on those committees and just saying, no, I'm not going to hear those bills.
Is it harder for you to be a mother or an advocate?
Well, both actually are hard. You know, I advocate for my daughter, but I also advocate for the millions of patients in the country that need this. And it's a big weight for all of the advocates to carry. I'm not the only advocate. There's a lot of us out there, right, who are doing this. And, you know, you just have to – I think the biggest thing I learned is this is a marathon, you know, not a sprint. And that was really tough, being a hard-headed Italian. I was like, oh, let's just get this done. Just pass it. It's good. You know, and in Virginia, it's taken 4 years just to get oils. But we have it for any patient who needs it. And that was huge, huge feat in a southern state. So if we can do that, you know, I think we just, you know, it's just going to take a little bit of time. And we need to stop conflating the argument between adult use and medical, too, and separate those. I think first medical is going to go through, and then we can, you know, think about the rest. I don't particularly care myself, but you know what I mean? Like, still, I think that's what's going to happen.
And I think that was always the strategy, right, Jason?
Yeah, that get
medical passed first.
Medical is the politically safe kind of, like, gives politicians that political cover to where they can say, oh, you know what, I support it medically, and it sounds good and hypothetically medically, but as far as adult use, maybe not so much. They want more research, more data. And that's why we have, you know, the laboratories of democracy of these states that are conducting these experiments. You know, California now being the largest state to conduct this type of experiment, so it's going to be amazing. You know, we're going to have a first legalized 420 where anyone 21 and over can go into state licensed stores and purchase cannabis for the first time on 420. And this is going to be a historical day.
Excellent. Just getting back to the film before we open it up to the audience, Jen and George, I wanted to ask you about the process of making a movie, of having a camera on you. Were there any reservations in being the face of medical marijuana and epilepsy for you, Jen? And George, what were the challenges that you faced in just telling this story?
Well, it really wasn't all that difficult, you know, just they're great to work with. So they made it really easy for me, and it wasn't that weird having a camera on me. I mean, I just kind of forgot about it. they made it very, very easy for me, and it would have been so much more difficult if I had worked with anyone else. But mainly I just thought about all the people I know with epilepsy or any other disease that, you know, they can use cannabis oil. And I just think of all of the people I met and all of the, like, people I've grown to be a family with. And it's not really even a decision, you know. I just, they can't speak for themselves. So, you know, I'm glad to be a voice for them.
No. George?
I'd say the most difficult part was holding the line on, we wanted to target people that wouldn't necessarily think of this as a medicine. And we wanted to hold the line on keeping at what you alluded to, you know, how is it presented? And the biggest thing I wanted to make sure was that for Jen and Beth, at the family, and how that conflict or how that narrative arc went for them on their journey stayed intact. And it was something that they're very comfortable with, because we told a story about a family that's still dealing with these legal struggles. And I do know that, you know, for it to work, that sort of care had to be taken with it. And it just was one of those things where we kept coming into some creative issues that if we didn't care about it, we could just get out of easily. But since we did, we really, as a team, had to put our heads together and say, okay, how do we tell this part? Because this is important. One, we want to get our story out here, but we don't want to wreck anyone's life. That's not our job. Our job is to help.
Yeah. So, Jen, what is next for you in your life? What is happening in your world?
Well, I'm going to continue lobbying with my mom. But I don't know. I was going to go to Nova in Virginia and figure out, you know, what I want to do. I really like music and playing guitar, so I don't know. Might try to become a musician.
I encourage that as the music editor of Variety. All right. Well, we will take some questions from the audience, and then, you guys, there's a cocktail hour. You can exit the theater that way, and we can hang out some more. So who's got questions? Just raise your hand. Anyone? Anyone? Yes. Oh, sorry. We have a microphone, so hang on 1 second.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My name is Sarah Armstrong. I'm Director of Industry Affairs for Americans for Safe Access. And in January, on top of all the other problems we have, taxes here shot up for patients dramatically. Now, I get a lot of complaints, but I bet Jason is on the front lines of that issue, and I'd like him to talk about what happens to patients when the price of their medicine just increases so dramatically.
Well, I know at our location, I know for a number of the flower products and certain products, we have lowered the price to try to help compensate with that, as well as we encourage all patients to go and get their obtain their state card, which they get from the health department. Because once you obtain that state card, then at that point you are sales tax exempt. Everyone has to pay the 15% excise tax, whether you're adult use or medical. Everyone has to pay sales tax. Unless you have a state card.
Is it still more affordable? Beth, can you tell us, is it still more affordable than pharmaceuticals that you would get?
No, because it's not covered by insurance.
Right.
So there's no copay. Right. No, it's again, very expensive.
Another hurdle.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think about all the time about the patients who are not as fortunate as we are to have income to be able to support her medicine.
Yeah.
Many people can't.
That's also I remember from the sort of nascent years of activism, people saying, it doesn't matter what it costs. Like, we will figure out the pricing. But it does, you know, and
absolutely.
It is an issue for people, absolutely. Okay, any other questions? Yep. Hang on 1 second, we'll get the microphone to you.
Hi, my name is Manuel Pardo, and I'm an HIV physician and also a researcher. And this question is going for Jason, but also for John. And it irates me really a lot to see how politicians can actually stop the development of this product, because I know that it has a lot of potential. So thank you guys for doing what you're doing. And I want to specifically ask a question. If you can give me, how do you see in the future, me as a physician and as a researcher taking care of patients, who multiple of them are actually on any of the cannabis products for many of the things that can actually help, insomnia, chronic pain, etc. And me doing research as well, I'm like appalled by the fact that the United States has not taken a leading act into like also doing more research for all of these products that for all of these benefits that this plant has for all of us. So I want you to tell me, both of you guys, how do you think in the future it will be for being of a more of a formal research for all of us as physicians to be able to prescribe medications for all of the different
ailments.
Illnesses that could actually be in cured by this plant, like, would you see soon, like, the research? Because I know that all of the research progress that go well, or the phases that go, will take a long time in order to be approved or whatnot. But how do you see yourself? Do you think it's organized enough, the cannabis industry, not only in California but in the United States, to have well-planned research protocols for the patients? And how do you see that timeline going? Because I know it's going to take at least 10 or 15 years until we have the very first products of cannabis.
Well, personally, I'm a big believer that I think that within 7 to 12 years, we're going to see a total shift in the descheduling of cannabis personally. But right now, in the meantime, we do have the federal government has been allowing for numerous types of research. And so, but that all has to go through the university system. And so I know that UCLA is going to be doing a cannabis studies and a number of other universities throughout the state now, but at the same time, they still have to get NIDA-approved cannabis, which comes from a government-supplied source, which is the government of Mississippi now. However, I am under the assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that they can start certain cultivations in these other universities as well. Just for instance, the state of Louisiana is about to start a medical cannabis program, and they are going to have only the universities are going to be the ones that are actually allowed to produce the product that the dispensaries will end up selling in Louisiana.
Yeah, Louisiana is hoping to get that forward. Southern University and LSU have applied to become the cultivators for the state. It's a very similar system to the way that Uruguay produces its adult use cannabis. And so that cannabis would not be able to be used in federally supported research. It would still have to come from Ole Miss. The hope is that lifts soon, but currently with Mr. Sessions in office, there isn't seemingly an end in sight, but hopefully cooler heads will prevail. To your question about broadening research, I think looking at what the federal government is doing is a recipe for the type of nausea that a lot of people use cannabis for, to be honest. And also, thank you for doing God's work, by the way, working with a community that's under-supported in a variety of ways. But you look around and you see a state like Colorado that's using set-aside tax funding to support research in the state. They have to still go through the federal system, but there is money coming from the states to support this. You see a state like Pennsylvania, their medical cannabis program is one that in the law, there's a required consortium among medical schools to get together and start to understand this drug in better ways. And so that formal research side is not being spurred by brilliant minds in the federal government. It's being spurred by state-level activism, and not the type of activism that Beth and Jen are necessarily working on, but activism within medical communities themselves to, you know, put their foot down and say, I know this works for my patients. I want to be able to study the reality that it works for my patients and other patients with a variety of symptoms and conditions. One of the most positive steps in this direction happened today. The FDA said for the first time that a cannabis-based, not a synthetic, but a cannabis-based medicine has passed all of the phases of FDA testing to be used. Now, there's going to have to be some rescheduling process for at least that drug itself to be able to be prescribed. But for the first time in American history, FDA has said, yes, a cannabis-based medicine helps.
Jen Progress. Is,
exactly. Jen has known this for years. Millions of patients have known this for years, for millennia, actually. But finally, the FDA is ready to move in that direction. We'll see more of this. And why? Because of people like you who see in their patients every day that this is real. And maybe you're not an advocate for a child of yours. I hope you're not in that position. But you're an activist all the same, even within the medical community, because you see every day what this can do. And you're talking to people who don't truly understand that it can do it. Films like these and others are hopefully opening the eyes of people who just wave it off as, oh, you know, they just want to get high and then they're going to end up becoming a heroin addict because that's how the gateway drug works. Jen is a very traditional-looking medical marijuana user in the United States. If you went with a sketch artist to Jeff Sessions and asked him, what does a medical marijuana user look like in the United States, they're not going to sketch an amazing, confident, powerful, well-intentioned 18-year-old woman. They're going to sketch something from Cheech and Chong. And to be able to bridge that divide is critical in this space. And it's critical for access. It's critical for patients to be treated with the respect that they deserve. But it's critical for research itself.
I think I can't imagine. Okay, one more question really quickly.
Congratulations on a great film. My name is William Dolphin. I've been writing about medical cannabis for 15 years now and trying to figure this out. And my question is mostly for you, John, because as a political scientist, I'm curious on your take of the politics of this. It's something I've tried to figure out for a long time. 85 to 90% support, true nationwide, all political parties, age demographics, doesn't matter how you slice it. What other issue is there that politicians don't see that and act on it? Right? Why is it that we have this political resistance, the Dianne Feinsteins, the Pete Sessions, the Jeff Sessions, when they understand that they're representing people who want it, that the mass of the country wants it? Is there anything else that is even remotely comparable?
There's not really much that's remotely comparable. I think the go-to issue is same-sex marriage, which over time changed in terms of public opinion for two reasons. One, very weakly, was generational replacement, but public opinion changed on same-sex marriage so rapidly that new people entering the electorate and people dying off was not a full explanation for that, or even a majority explanation for that. One was experience. And essentially immersion therapy for the United States. You had a loving couple across the street who happened to be two gay men or two lesbians, and you suddenly realized that when you went to their picnic, you didn't catch it, right? You didn't go home and say, damn it, I'm gay now. Ugh. And so it helped people through this. I think the same is happening with cannabis. People are... The demographics in the United States are changing in terms of who's most supportive and who's least supportive, but they're also meeting people like Jen or knowing people in their own family who this happens to, and that's helping change public opinion to where we are. Now, that was the part of your question. The other is, well, why isn't Congress responding to that type of pressure? And the reality is there's not a lot of pressure, and here's why. There's a difference between support for an issue and the salience of an issue, right? So there's about 60 to 65% support for adult use cannabis reform in the United States. There's about 85 to 90% support for medical cannabis reform in the United States. Since Gallup has been polling about the top 20 issues that are most important to Americans in the 1960s, and they've polled on it every month since then, cannabis policy has never made the top 20. So what does that do? It signals to an elected official, yeah, vote how you want on this. We're not going to hold you accountable. Who's been thrown out of office because they have voted against a cannabis initiative? No one. But that's changing now too. People are being – their feet are being held to the fire because of their position against cannabis. You have – if you told me 5 years ago that there would be a young progressive guy running for – the U.S. Senate in Texas against a sitting incumbent who's a religious conservative, and part of his platform is nationwide legalization of marijuana, I would have laughed in your face, or laughed in Beto O'Rourke's face, who thought he was going to become a United States senator from Texas. But the reality is this is something that his political advisors are not pulling him aside and saying, hey, Beto, cut the pot talk because it's not going to play well outside Dallas. They're saying, yeah, talk about it. You know why? Because you're going to win Democrats and you're going to win Republicans on this issue and you're going to win independents on this issue. And the guy you're running against has a position on this that a majority of Texans disagree with. It's an issue that, again, maybe people aren't getting thrown out of office on, but increasingly people are willing to be as brave as Beth and Jen are and stand up in front of a legislature and say, this is important. It's important for them to do it, but it's more important for the chairman of the Rules Committee in the House to do it, or the Speaker of the House, or the majority whip in the Senate to do it. And increasingly, people with those positions are going to be moving into leadership and throwing the people out who, as you said, have a position diametrically opposed to a supermajority of Americans. That's not how a Republican democracy works, but pretty soon it's going to be how a Republican democracy works on the issue of cannabis.
Wow. Well, guys, thank you so much. Beth, Jen, thanks for being involved in this film. George, for making the film. Jason, for everything you do. John, you are a very, very smart man. enjoy the cocktails, and happy 420, everybody.